From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College, this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Chloe Wittenberg.
And I'm Amy DePiro.
This week on War News Radio, Precious Metals, we first learn about the economic potential of Afghanistan's vast mineral deposits.
And in fact, I've been publishing that for over 30 years now, that Afghanistan could be raised by its own bootstraps by these rich resources. But of course, you have to have the willingness of the Afghan population to allow these resources to be mined, or otherwise they're going to be shooting at foreigners trying to steal their resources.
Then we hear about the music of an Iraqi war veteran.
When I get through to someone and they say something like, "You mean I'm not the only one? I'm not crazy?" And I say, no, you're not, friend. And it just reminds me a lot of me and what I went through. And it's very humbling to have people send me emails and tell me that I saved their lives. No, I don't know what to do with that except keep playing.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Afghanistan's intelligence agency is reporting the arrest of six men for plotting to assassinate President Hamid Karzai. A Karzai spokesman links those arrested to a member of Al-Qaeda and the Haqqani network. The foiled plot marks the third attempt to kill Karzai since he took office in 2002 and is the latest development in a string of assassinations of high-ranking officials blamed on the Haqqani network, including the recent killing of former Afghan President Burhanuddin Rabbani.
Four insurgents disguised as police officers, but wearing explosive vests, took control of a police station in Iraq's Anbar province and held dozens of hostages for several hours. Iraqi security forces eventually stormed the station, but two of the insurgents blew themselves up, killing four hostages. Iraqi officials report that security forces killed the other two insurgents and were able to free the remaining hostages. The attack highlights questions about security in Iraq as the United States military prepares to withdraw at the end of this year.
A drone strike in northern Yemen killed Anwar al-Awlaki, a leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and an American citizen. Awlaki, who was born in New Mexico, studied engineering at Colorado State University and preached Islam in the United States until 2002. He utilized the internet to encourage terrorism in the West. U.S. officials had drawn connections between Awlaki and two 9/11 hijackers, the shooting at Fort Hood, the failed Detroit underwear bomber, and the man who tried to set off a car bomb in Times Square. Awlaki's assassination has prompted backlash from civil libertarians who claim the killing violates the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit last year on behalf of Awlaki's father to prevent the government from targeting Awlaki, but a federal court threw out the case.
Admiral Mike Mullen has stepped down from his post as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff after a 43-year military career. Mullen's replacement, Army General Martin Dempsey, has extensive experience working in the Middle East, having served as an advisor to Saudi Arabia's security forces and having commanded American forces across the Middle East and Asia. In his new position, Dempsey faces significant budget cuts and the scheduled drawdown in Iraq and Afghanistan.
A recent poll by the Washington-based Pew Research Center shows that one in three United States military veterans who served post-9/11 believe that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are not worth fighting. The wars have claimed the lives of nearly 6,200 American troops and have cost the U.S. over $1 trillion.
United States Defense Secretary Leon Panetta made his first trip to the Middle East this week, stopping in Israel and then Egypt, where he urged officials to lift the country's emergency law before elections in November. While the Egyptian ruling military council has promised to abandon or change the law, it has not committed to a specific date. Panetta also encouraged Egypt to release Ilan Grapel, a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen who Egypt accuses of being an Israeli spy. Grapel has remained in prison since July 12th.
China and Russia have vetoed a United Nations Security Council resolution condemning the Syrian government for its violent crackdown on protesters. The United States and European Union have publicly denounced China and Russia for failing to defend the human rights of Syrian civilians. According to the UN, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's military crackdown has resulted in more than 2,700 deaths since mid-March. The opposition leader, Syrian National Council President Burhan Ghaliyun, has cautioned that the failure of the international community to act could lead to increased violence.
An al-Qaeda-linked group known as al-Shabaab is claiming responsibility after a suicide truck bomber struck a government building in Somalia's capital of Mogadishu, killing over 75 people and injuring 90. President Sharif Sheikh Ahmed announced a three-day mourning period, but al-Shabaab stated that the attacks will increase day by day. In August, African Union forces took control of Mogadishu, though al-Shabaab vowed to wage strikes on government establishments in the capital.
This is War News Radio. Since a Pentagon task force came out with a 2007 report claiming that Afghanistan possessed over $1 trillion in untapped mineral resources, mining in Afghanistan has been a hot topic. In this report, Jared Nolan examines the current state of mining operations in Afghanistan and what challenges and opportunities the future might hold. This is part 5 of an ongoing series documenting the economy of Afghanistan and the measures required to sustain the Afghan state.
Jack Schroeder has studied the mineral wealth of Afghanistan for a long time. It's a recent story, though, that captures the current state of the country's mining industry.
I was working for an American company up until last month that was trying to get involved in the lithium and in the rare earths, and they finally got cold feet. I kept telling them, I said, this is the Wild West over there, man, and I'm prepared to go into the country and do what we need to do. And I hope your investors are, you know, got deep enough pockets to roll with us, because I think we can pull it off, particularly with the information that I have and the contacts I have. I think we can have the winning bid. But they finally pulled out. And they never said why, but I know it's because they really didn't understand the Wild West nature of working in a country like that.
Schroeder is a geology professor at the University of Nebraska and a mining consultant. He claims the resources are there, but few are willing to take the risks to extract them. The mineral wealth of Afghanistan is no secret. For centuries, Afghans have used crude techniques to extract gemstones that were once traded on the Silk Road. Modern assessments started in the 1950s and 60s when Soviet geologists began documenting the region's resources. Since then, the world has intermittently forgotten and remembered Afghanistan's potential wealth. But Schroeder, who began working in Afghanistan in the 70s, has always been preaching their value.
And in fact, I've been publishing that for over 30 years now, that Afghanistan could be raised by its own bootstraps by these rich resources. But of course, you have to have the willingness of the Afghan population to allow these resources to be mined, or otherwise they're going to be shooting at foreigners trying to steal their resources.
There's a laundry list of minerals present in the country. There are metals like copper, iron, nickel, gold, silver, and aluminum. There are gemstones, emeralds, rubies, topaz, and the world-renowned lapis lazuli. There are also industrial minerals like graphite, brick, clay, sulfur, and rare earth elements including lithium. Plus building materials, marble, granite, limestone, and sandstone. So what is being done with all these resources?
Well, there's the artisanal mining, you know, the emeralds, mostly, I guess, in the northeast. But those are, you know, people with shovels and picks and that type of thing. But if what you mean are there more, you know, organized mines, you know, with modern machinery, there's not really.
Gary McMahon is a senior mining specialist with the World Bank. Although there are no major mines operating, there are a couple in development. One is at Aynak, an hour's drive south of Kabul. INAC holds the second largest known unexploited copper deposit in the world. In 2007, the Ministry of Mines auctioned off the deposit, and the winning bidder was the China Metallurgical Group Corporation, or MCC, a huge state-backed Chinese conglomerate. The process was cast in doubt when Afghan authorities arrested ex-Minister of Mines Ibrahim Adel on accusations that he took a $30 million bribe from MCC. Even without the bribery accusation, however, MCC still had the best bid, and the contract represents the largest foreign investment in the history of Afghanistan.
It was probably the best contract I've ever seen that a government got.
The total package came to over $1 billion more than any of the competitors. The signing bonus was the largest, and it offered the highest royalties to the Afghan government. Included in the bid are many infrastructure projects that MCC will build. A 400-megawatt power plant for the mine and to contribute electricity to blackout-prone Kabul, a new coal mine to feed the generator, a smelter to refine the copper ore, an extensive railroad from Uzbekistan in the north to Pakistan in the south to carry copper ore back to China, schools, roads, health clinics, and even mosques for the local communities, and compensation to landowners. American, Canadian, and Australian companies could not compete with all that, according to Schroeder.
Western companies are not set up necessarily as development agencies, whereas the Chinese government, being communist and all of that, has got a very tidy way of doing business, where the corporate side is entirely involved in the resource extraction, and they're very comfortably aligned with their government, which can provide a lot of development. That's actually a super good way to do business, if in fact they follow through on it in an honest way.
So now the question is whether MCC can deliver on all its promises. Integrity Watch Afghanistan is a national watchdog agency, and its extractive industries monitoring manager, Javed Noorani, has kept close tabs on the projects.
You see, the social investment the Chinese have committed themselves to, they're going to be implemented soon. You know, the last meeting I had with them was, they said six projects are lined up, to be implemented in the next 9 months.
The outcome of the railroad is less certain.
The Chinese are trying to do a feasibility study of the railway line, and once they complete their feasibility study, then they will implement it. But as of now, no more information on this with us, and they're just conducting the feasibility study.
The mine is expected to open in 2014, but setbacks have stalled its progress. Workers uncovered cultural artifacts on the site, and a rush to preserve them has led to the most recent delay. Experts also harbor concerns whether the Ministry of Mines has the capacity to effectively regulate and monitor such a large project. The ministry, with little experience in untested laws, will encounter many challenges holding MCC to the contract. Schroeder identifies one.
The ore body is so big that it'll be a deep strip mine, which will probably screw up the water table. Not probably, it definitely will. And so the local people will once they see trouble with their water supplies, they'll fight even more than they are now. So that has to be handled extremely well.
Especially since MCC does not have a stellar track record adhering to environmental standards. News reports exposed MCC mines in Pakistan and Papua New Guinea that have transgressed environmental standards. Thomas Rutig, co-director of the Afghanistan Analyst Network, anticipates another problem.
Learning from lessons from other countries, from Chad and Nigeria and part of Indonesia and so on, it can be clearly seen that as long as you don't have transparent institutions, the wealth generated, if mining starts in Afghanistan, might end up in the same corrupt channels where now resources for development and reconstruction end up.
Because of these concerns, Noorani thinks that the Ministry of Mines should slow down and accumulate more experience and knowledge.
You know, why are you in a hurry to give more concessions if you know your capacity is not proportionate to the kind of investment you're inviting? It's like, it will exhaust the existing capacity within Ministry of Mines. So we're telling them, please acquire more capacity, so that you can monitor and regulate things. Otherwise, you won't be in a position to do that.
To help with this process, the ministry has brought in consultants from the United States, Canada, and London as advisors. The country has also applied for membership to the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, a global organization that holds member countries to responsible use of natural resources. With this oversight, the Ministry of Mines started the bidding process for the other well-documented deposit in Afghanistan, the Hajigak iron deposit. It's not as well explored as Aynak, but it's still classified by the British Geological Survey as world-class, containing an estimated 1.8 billion tons of iron ore. The ministry has received 6 bids for the deposit. 2 of them come from firms in India, as well as 2 from Iran, 1 from the US and 1 from Canada. One of the Indian bids, the early favorite, is a consortium led by state-run Steel Authority of India. The range of countries involved in the bidding has led some to describe the competition for resources as the new great game.
Afghanistan's got the potential, and I'm optimistic that the place will get cleaned up and get developed, but it also has the potential because of all the players involved, India, Pakistan, China, Iran, that are messing around in the country, it has the potential to be even a worse swamp in 10 years than it is now.
In all, though, Jack Schroeder is more of an optimist, so he thinks Afghanistan has the potential to come out as a reasonably developed and educated country. This will depend on the government's ability to responsibly manage revenue from the mines, and also whether it can maintain a secure environment that will attract more investors. After all, the minerals aren't worth much when they're stuck in the ground. For War News Radio, I'm Jared Nolan.
This is War News Radio. Iraq War veteran Jason Moon recently released a collection of songs that convey the struggles veterans can face while transitioning between the battlefield and life back home. Since the album's release, Moon has become an inspiration to veterans across the country. War News Radio's Zach Wunroe spoke with Moon about how he has reconciled his past of post-traumatic stress disorder through music and activism.
No greater crime that someone should leave their community and serve to protect it, only to come back to that community and feel isolated from the very community they serve to protect.
That's Jason Moon of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, discussing how he felt upon coming home after a tour in Iraq in 2004. After having been deployed to Iraq for 11 months as a general construction equipment operator with the U.S. Army, Moon returned to a community in which he felt that he was unable to voice his opinions and experiences.
I would say something that I saw at an event that took place, and they would, and someone would tell me that that doesn't happen or we don't do that. And then I would get very frustrated because I was there while they were at home. But, you know, the media wasn't really reporting the war that I had seen. And so there just was no one to speak to, really.
Moon remembers feeling isolated as he struggled to readjust to his life at home. He suffered symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, as have an estimated 30% of veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. According to the American Psychiatric Association, PTSD develops in response to a traumatic event, and its symptoms include psychological intrusion, avoidance, and arousal. Moon recalls the emotions he experienced during the time as large and very dangerous. Although he had once been a prolific songwriter, Moon was unable to finish a single song in 5 years. Finally, in 2009, he was invited to write a song for filmmaker Olivier Morel's documentary about war trauma called On the Bridge, which comes out this week. Soon, Moon found himself capturing fragments of his emotions and transcribing them into songs. He describes the process that would result in his first album in almost a decade.
It was kind of dangerous because emotional boxes of stuff, if you will, open, trying to stuff them into a lot of songs at once. And but I finally got them on the CD and recorded it, and that was kind of the process of just inviting the monster of PTSD onto my turf.
Now, Nearly 7 years after coming home, Moon has finally found a way of expressing his experiences to an audience that listens. On New Year's Day, he released a folk rock album entitled Trying to Find My Way Home that deals with the struggles veterans face at home. Although songwriting would ultimately become a healing process for Moon, the songs on his new album vary greatly in tone, sometimes desperate and other times hopeful.
It kind of turned into an accidental concept album, but each one of those was basically an emotion. And the can't stay here was, realizing that as much as alcohol helped get me out of immediate pain, it just kept getting me into more trouble. It's closing time. I ain't got a dime. I got whiskey on my mind, but I can't stay. There's some anger, you know, and then there's some more of more desperation. Hold On was just a complete and utter cry of desperation. Hold on. Hold on. I really like Another Day Like This. I think it's probably my favorite song, where it starts out, I don't want to live another day like this, to I'm not going to, you know, to kind of to reframe that statement. It's the most hopeful piece on the CD, I believe. Live another day like this, there ain't enough thing that I'm gonna miss. I'm gonna live every day like it's my last day alive.
Upon the release of this album, Moon gave himself the mission of raising $25,000 for veterans' causes by 2013. He donates the money as he makes it, sending it to veterans' organizations like the Milwaukee Homeless Veterans Initiative and Soldier's Heart. Since January, Moon has been fundraising across the country by performing his music and leading interactive presentations on post-traumatic stress disorder. Despite his commitment to fulfilling his mission, there are moments when he has doubts about whether his efforts are worthwhile.
It breaks my heart that there's so many veterans out there who don't know they're not alone. And every day, 18 veterans commit suicide, and sometimes it feels like the work I'm doing is just a drop in the bucket. But other times I get through the veterans and I get through the civilians, and so then it's rewarding.
Army veteran Hugh Scanlon remembers seeing Moon perform at a Soldier's Heart retreat in Atlanta last year. Even though Scanlon is a Vietnam veteran, he says the struggles he endured as a soldier coming home in 1969 still hold true today. On this level, he can relate to Moon's music.
His music strikes a chord with me. I can't listen to it without shedding a tear, because I know the pain and heartache that the two wars we're in right now are causing these young men.
Of all the songs on Moon's album, Scanlon can relate to the title track most. In his mind, Trying to Find My Way Home is a kind of anthem for veterans.
It's every soldier's song. To me, it's almost like Flanders Field. I know exactly what he's saying, and I felt the same way. You just go, I know I'm here, and my feet are back home, but I'm not here. Inside me, long dead and gone, somewhere between
lost and alone, trying to find my way. Johanna Buwalda is a psychotherapist in Chicago who works with war survivors. In her interactions with military veterans, she has found that many veterans go through destructive steps, such as post-traumatic stress and substance abuse, and reach a point where they feel as if they can't move on to the steps of healing. At this point, she says Moon's music can help.
That last CD that he did, Finding My Way Home, illustrates all those steps very beautifully. So I sometimes even give this CD to veterans who think that there is no hope for them. It almost always speaks to them.
Moon is not only trying to speak to the veteran. In his presentations on post-traumatic stress disorder, Moon is hoping to go one step further in preventing soldiers that are coming home from feeling as isolated as he did in 2004. He is conveying his belief that the veteran's burden of experiences should be placed on civilian shoulders too. He says to civilians that they are obligated to listen to however much or however little the veteran has to say. Moon expresses what he hopes to achieve as he continues to travel across the United States.
Hopefully educate every single civilian in the United States about what PTSD is and why it's their responsibility to care,
about veterans, and then get through to every veteran who's come back from these two wars and let them know they're not alone and that PTSD is not a weakness. So, should be able to get that done by Christmas. I'm kidding.
Moon laughs off this deadline. However, in the 9 months that have passed since he started his mission, he has already raised $9,000 and traveled 16,000 miles. Moon says that if he is able to bring any kind of understanding or healing, no distance is too far for him to travel. He has another 15 months left to fulfill his mission, but he needs no encouragement. In his interactions with other veterans, he is reminded often of why he should keep pursuing his mission.
When I get through to someone and they say something like, "You mean I'm not the only one? I'm not crazy?" And I say, no, you're not, friend. And it just reminds me a lot of me and what I went through. And it's very humbling to have people send me emails and tell me that I saved their lives. You know, I don't know what to do with that except keep playing and keep on doing what I'm doing.
You can get involved with Moon's cause and find out more about his new CD by going to jasonmoon.org. The documentary On the Bridge premieres at the Chicago International Film Festival on October 8th. More information can be found at onthebridgethemovie.com. For War News Radio, I'm Zach Winrow.
How do they expect a man to do the things that I have, come back and be the same? The things I've done that I regret, the things I've seen I won't forget, for this life and so many more. And I'm trying to find my way home. The child inside me is long dead and gone, somewhere between lost and alone, trying to find my way home.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Natalia Choi, Caroline Badden, Eliana Biscard-Church, Rosanna Kim, Sam Hirschman, Amandine Lee, Max Nestorak, Jared Nolan, Colin Smith, and Alan Zhao. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Amy DePiro.
And I'm Chloe Wittenberg. Until next time, thanks for listening.